evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Brooke Hansen. Hansen is an associate professor of anthropology at Ithaca College and the coordinator of Native American Studies. She is also co-coordinator of the Integrative Health Studies Program and serves on the Ithaca Health Alliance's Community Relations Committee. She's also a co-founder of SHARE, a group that helped facilitate getting the land back to the Cuga Indian Nation. Welcome to the show, Brooke.
Thank you.
Now, but when you first began your educational journey, did you know that you were going to become an anthropologist?
I knew I was going to become an anthropologist after I took my first anthropology class. I'd been majoring in psychology at the University of South Florida, and I love psychology and I love the idea of reaching out to people. But when I took that first class that exposed me to the multicultural world out there, I realized there's so many other perspectives to explore. I wanted to be an anthropologist. My other excuse is that I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do with my life, and anthropology is the study of humans in all time periods and everything they do. So I thought, I'll be covered if I do anthropology.
Now you describe yourself as a cultural and medical anthropologist. Tell us, you know, in sort of a little outline what that means.
Yes, that can be confusing for many people. They hear the word anthropology and somehow Indiana Jones pops into their mind and they think of archaeologists raiding tombs and unearthing great treasures.
Yes.
And I often get, oh, you're an anthropologist, so you dig bones. No, don't much like digging or bones. I study contemporary human cultures. The medical anthropology part comes in because I study the health and healing practices of all cultures. So it doesn't mean I'm a physician or a nurse or a clinician. It just means I study healing practices in their cultural context.
Mm-hmm. And did it take you a while to evolve to this discipline? Did you try other aspects of anthropology beforehand?
I pretty much went right into cultural and medical because I've always been interested in healing and alternative healing. I've had a lot of cancer and other illness misfortunes in my own family, and I think that kind of pushed me to figure out there must be other answers out there besides Western medicine, which has not been very effective in my own life.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's hone in on some of the specific issues you've been involved in. You're incredibly involved and active in the Cuga land claim. Cuga Nation. Talk to us about how you got involved.
I got involved with that in 1999. The Cayuga land claim case was going back into the courts to figure out a settlement. The Cayugas had won their case in 1980 in the federal district court in Syracuse that said, yes, New York messed up. They illegally annexed the last 64,000 acres of your land, and they should do something about it. Well, somehow that went from 1980 to 1999 and nothing was ever done. A settlement was never agreed upon. So it was going to go back into the courts for the courts to finally decide what do the Cayugas get as a result of that judgment. What that did is it fueled the local anti-Indian movement that largely operates under the group Upstate Citizens for Equality to put signs in their yard protesting the idea of Cayugas coming home or protesting the idea of Cayugas getting money for the injustices of what had happened to them. And when I saw the sign, scalp the land claim, go NRA, something clicked inside of me and I realized as an educator, a mother, and a community member, I needed to learn more about this and to do something.
Mm-hmm. And so you were able to combine your scholarly discipline and your public person activism and bring this whole thing together, which is quite amazing.
Exactly, and it's a growing area in anthropology today. Sometimes we call it activist anthropology, sometimes we call it public anthropology, and it's really about getting our discipline out of the ivory tower and into communities so we can make a difference. So I was really fortunate that I had been teaching Native American studies for several years before I encountered the situation. So I was already somewhat well-versed in the Iroquois or the Haudenosaunee, the land claim issues. So it was really a perfect coming together for me. But I think in many ways, it was my role as a mother. My daughter is part Native American.
Mm.
I went into my local post office one day, and I heard some of the postal workers joking about getting guns and shooting Indians.
Really?
And that was another catalyst for me realizing racism is not dead, it's alive and well, and it's right here in our communities around Ithaca. So all of those things came together to fuel me to want to understand more. Mm-hmm. So I went to one of the land claim hearings in Syracuse in 1999, and that's when I met a local community woman, Julie Uticone from Seneca Falls. She was in the back, and I overheard her talking about trying to do something to educate people to get rid of the racism. So, of course, I went right up to her and said, hey, I'm an educator. Maybe I can help. And she was thinking about forming a group at that time, and I said, I would love to be part of it. And so my partner, Jack Rawson, Ernie Olson from Wells College, and several other educators, we showed up at Julie's house one day in Seneca Falls, and that's where SHARE was born. Mm. And SHARE stands for Strengthening Haudenosaunee American Relations Through Education, which is why we just call it SHARE, because that's a mouthful. Mm-hmm. And we were very committed to trying to provide an alternative space and another view of this land claim. Instead of the fear and the racism that we were seeing in the community, we wanted to provide education. We wanted to correct the miseducation that people have been getting about treaties and the role of New York State and things like that. And so we formed SHARE, and Julie wanted to connect us more to the Cayuga Nation. So she called the office many days in a row, and Sharon, who answered the phone, was like, some crazy white lady's calling and wants to help out. What should we do with her? Oh, I don't know. Get rid of her. Julie was very persistent and kept calling. And then one day Sharon's like, okay, Bertie, will you please talk to this woman? She wants to help us. And that was Bernadette Hill, or Bertie Hill, the Heron clan mother of the Cayuga Nation. And something clicked for Bertie when she heard Julie speaking as a resident in the land claim area who has family members in UCE, and she was very touched that this woman wanted to reach out. Mm-hmm. So Bertie decided to go to Julie's house one day, and things took off from there.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, in what way do you educate? Are you speaking to people who, you know, are already on your side? How do you get into these communities that are full of prejudice and hatred?
Well, we did a couple different things in order to try to expand the education as far as possible. We developed a shared newsletter and mailed it out to over 800 people. Jack and I are part of the Partnership in Teaching program at Ithaca College, and we have been into every school in this district and some out of the district talking about the Cayuga's land claim issues, the importance of homeland, and things like that. And we also started doing a Native American festival up at Wells College called the Peachtown Festival. Mm. And then we moved into having a festival here in Ithaca called the Homecoming Festival. And this year in September, on the 20th and 21st, we'll be having those festivals back-to-back. Homecoming at Tutelo Park on the 20th, and Peachtown Festival at Wells on the 21st. And the fundamental idea with a Native American festival is you get people together to dance, to share food, to listen to music, and that's how you start to break down the barriers of cross-cultural misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm. But I would think people who are anti-Native American wouldn't come to these festivals.
Right, and that's why I go to Seneca Falls, to Minders Academy, which is one of the centers of the Upstate Citizens for Equality group, every year, and I talk to the entire senior class or however many classes they get together, and I talk to a lot of UCE kids. And we also, in 2001, we purchased a farm just south of Union Springs.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that's another venue that we used for education. And we invited everyone, UCE members, other anti-Indian movement people, just curious local community people, come on by and we'll talk.
Mm-hmm. And do you think you've changed any hearts and minds directly?
I think we did. When we first purchased the share farm in 2001, the first thing that happened was UCE put up protest signs on both sides of the farm. No Cayugas, no Cayuga reservation, no, no, no. And we thought, oh boy, we wanted to go rip the signs down.
Oh, yeah.
We said, oh, we don't want that there. Bertie said, no. You leave the signs there, and it's a reminder of the work that we are all doing. So we never touched those signs. Mm-hmm. We did fundraising for 3 or 4 years to pay off as much of the mortgage as we could. And in 2005, we transferred the farm to the Cayuga Nation of New York. And what happened the week after the transfer, the signs came down.
Mm.
The man who put the signs up said, I like everyone I've met at this farm. I've learned a lot from the clan mothers you've introduced me to. It's time for these signs to come down and for some healing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we know at least one case where someone decided that they had been transformed. They might not agree with all of the principles that the Cayuga Nation agrees with, such as sovereignty and things like that, but they wanted to take the sign down. We've seen a lot of UCE signs come down in the past 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I've seen fewer as I drive around that area as well. Are there aspects of Native American culture that you have integrated into your own personal life?
I wouldn't say so much except for the environmental philosophies. The Haudenosaunee and the Cayugas that we work with and the Onondagas are still very committed to trying to find a balance between humans and the environment, of being sustainable. They still have so much wisdom with this that we can all learn. So at what is now the Cayuga Share Farm, we still put in a Three Sisters mound every year and grow the corn, beans, and squash in the traditional way, which makes a lot of sense. So I think it's the environmental philosophies, especially in the time that we're in, that continues to really impact me.
Now, you were also involved in the Central New York Native American Consortium. Is that a different aspect of this educational?
Yeah, the Central New York Native American Consortium is an affiliated group to Ithaca College and to SHARE. And what it is, it's a group of colleges, universities, and Native nations that all collaborate together to try to raise awareness about Native issues. We originally started out trying to get Native Studies programs in all the colleges along the I-81 corridor, as we kind of call it. You know, SUNY Cortland, Lemoyne, Syracuse University, Cornell, Ithaca College, Wells College, and right up to SUNY Oswego. And as we did launch into that, we also began doing programming and sharing speakers like Winona LaDuc at the different colleges. We've worked on issues like the Native American mascot issue together. So it's just another way that we can collaborate to try to build this consciousness about Native American presence and culture. A lot of people still think that Native Americans are gone, they're a thing of the past. And it's amazing how many students I get at Ithaca College. Oh, there are Native Americans here in New York State? Yeah, in fact, right down the road. Let's go visit them and learn about their culture. So it's really just part of that broader agenda of educating.
Yeah, and it probably has been a real challenge for Native Americans to keep their own culture. I mean, obviously, the people who think there aren't Native Americans anymore think they've all integrated.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah.
And for a long time, Native American cultures, they had to be very closed because so much had been taken from them by anthropologists and lots of other folks, too. Sacred items, their language was beaten out of them in boarding schools. Their culture was taken away from them by the U.S. government and churches and other entities. So there was a time period in the middle of the 20th century where a lot of Native nations closed down because they had to try to protect what was left before everything was taken from them. And it's only been the last 10 or 20 years that an opening has happened as they realize they need to make these connections with other communities in order for everyone to be educated.
And so on the other hand, are you also having to educate anthropologists and archaeologists and so on about the integrity of what they're looking for and not destroying some of the cultural artifacts and so on that they find?
Yeah, absolutely. American anthropology was very much founded on studying Native cultures. And I feel that in a lot of ways, we sucked our discipline out of those cultures and we have not given back enough. In small ways, we have given back. We made dictionaries and we took linguistic tapings that now Native nations can use to revitalize their language. But aside from that, we also took their ancestors right out of the ground and put them in the Smithsonian and other institutions. So my partner Jack Rawson at Ithaca College and I are trying to really forge this new vision of anthropology. He does it as an archaeologist, and I do it as a cultural anthropologist.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brooke Hansen. She's an associate professor of anthropology at Ithaca College. On that same note that we were just talking about, you actually co-wrote an article with Jack Rosen about public anthropology. Tell us what that means. It's an interesting idea. It almost sounds like political activism.
It's definitely about political activism. And we're hearing from some of our colleagues in sociology that they, too, are forging this thing called public sociology, which is about doing applied work that benefits human communities. And it does have an activist component. And it also means that as academics and scholars, we become positioned. And we're saying that's okay to have a position because we're working on this aspect of culture change for the better. trying to educate people, trying to clean up the environment, you know, whatever the project is. It's really about getting out there and bring our students with us to try to help them see how can we transform the world in a very proactive way. Mm-hmm. And it's been a wonderful, fulfilling endeavor to do that. But I have to say, there are a few bodies that have not caught up with that, and that would be tenure and promotion committees.
Ah.
And we're hearing this all around the country, that if you engage in activism, they don't want to define that as scholarship.
I was just going to ask you about that. That must ruffle some feathers in the academic world.
It ruffled feathers when my tenure file came up, and we pushed back. And
really?
We said, no, this is scholarship in our discipline. We have always been out there working in communities. We're just now coalescing it under this title of public anthropology. That is the work I do, and it's what I write about. So we had to re-educate the tenure and promotion committee for about 4 months to convince them that, you know, we cannot afford the old-time ivory tower scholarship anymore.
Mm-hmm.
With everything going on in the world, we need everyone to be getting out there. In fact, tenure and promotion should be how much have you changed the world? And if you haven't enough, then out you should go.
I agree. I think the educational system should be out changing the world and changing people's hearts and minds and educating people about reality. Indeed.
Right.
Margaret Mead was a great example of somebody who was doing that really early on. She turned on the, you know, normal population to her subjects.
Absolutely. And we consider her to be really one of the founders of both applied anthropology and now this thing we're calling public anthropology. She's right in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we run out of time, I want to talk about the medical issues that you're involved in. You say one of your main interests is medical pluralism. Tell us what that means.
And that's just really the idea that we do have more than Western medicine to draw upon to heal ourselves. And we should take advantage of it, especially here in Ithaca. I've been involved with a number of initiatives in the community over the years related to integrative medicine, or how do we take all these different options, Western medicine, Chinese medicine, Ayurveda from India, and weave them all together so that we have the best choices for our health care. And I was amazed, in Ithaca alone, there are over 300 practitioners of alternative and integrative modalities.
It is quite amazing.
It is amazing. We are very fortunate, so we need to take advantage of that, because not everyone has that. I've lived in communities that there is nothing except a local town doctor.
Mm-hmm.
No other choices.
Now, do you think so many people in Western medicine are reluctant to let alternative medicines come in, mainly because of money?
It's a turf war. It's about money, it's about power, and it's about ideology. And we see it replicated over and over again in relationships between doctors and alternative practitioners. There's a hierarchy there that we're having trouble breaking down. And we want everyone to be on equal ground, equal footing, the acupuncturist, the MD, the surgeon, the massage therapist. But there are, as I say, these turf wars involved with these issues. And New York State does not help the matter by only licensing a very small number of alternative modalities.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a license, you've got credentials, but what about the community herbalist who cannot get a license and is now devalued in the system because of that? So there are major inequities that I would like to see addressed.
I think it's quite amazing how many of our drugs actually come from the roots of herbs, but we've manufactured them in such a way that we think we have ownership.
And community herbalism is actually one of the answers to so many problems that we have today. Chinese medicine and Chinese herbs, they have a lot to offer, but think about what it takes to get a Chinese herb from China onto a crate, onto a boat or a plane, the gasoline, the fuel to get it here to America, to truck it to Ithaca so we can go buy it in a store,
mm-hmm.
versus there are many plants around this area that we could use that would have the same impact.
Mm-hmm.
So we could help the environment and help our bodies and reduce the number of pesticides that go into our local environment if we could revalue these local plants as medicine.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been involved with what you term health democracy movements. Tell us what that means.
And that's really an inspiration of Paul Glover, who I worked with many years ago when he started the Ithaca Health Fund, this idea of making health a democratic just an area that everybody can access, which currently is not the case.
No,
we have so
absolutely
many
not.
Uninsured yeah. people. And this is one of the reasons that I got involved with the Ithaca Health Fund, which later became the Ithaca Health Alliance. And we opened the Ithaca Free Clinic in 2006. And right now, we expect about 2,500 people to use the free clinic in 2008. And as many as 1,500 will be using it as their primary source of care. So we wanted to get something into the community to try to address these issues of inequity and people not being able to access medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really health democracy and what it's about. But more importantly, the Ithaca Free Clinic is one of the few clinics in the country that has integrated different modalities. And I'm not saying it was an easy process, but it's really important that there's still an herbalist on staff. There are chiropractors involved and other kinds of
acupuncturists.
Practitioners.
Yeah,
exactly.
I was quite impressed.
Mm-hmm. Working with Western doctors and nurses and physical therapists and folks like that.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have a model right here in Ithaca for other people to come see.
It's quite amazing how that's happened. On the other hand, are you going to get involved in electoral politics in regard to the healthcare issue? It certainly is up front and center in the political campaign.
Right, it is front and center, and any chance I get, I do, and go speak at forums and things like that in the community to try to raise awareness. And I do love Ithaca, and I'm so thrilled that we have so many of these social movements going on in our community. I joke sometimes, someday I'm going to be the mayor of Ithaca. I love this place so much. But I don't think I really move into politics.
I think
that
you probably
level.
Are doing the right thing in not being involved in politics if you love it so much.
Right.
It's a great way to make enemies.
Right.
Now you wrote an article about drugs in our water for the Ithaca Healthcare Alliance. To tell us about that subject, it's so frightening.
As a medical anthropologist, I spend a lot of time in my classes talking about Western medicine as a culture. And a lot of people say, but Western medicine is science. Well, sure, a lot of it's based on science. But when you look at practices like over-medicalization, pharmaceutical companies pushing docs to push medicines, that's capitalism. That's not Western medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And that
mm-hmm.
results in all of us being over-medicalized, taking too many antibiotics, too many other pharmaceuticals that we may need or may not need. Sometimes they don't even know.
Well, it's coming home to roost now. A lot of people are becoming immune to antibiotics.
Right, yeah, that's a huge issue. But still, we are, as a culture, we are a pill-popping culture. When we go to the doctor, we want something. We don't want the doctor to say, well, I don't know what's wrong with you, so go home and wait a while. We want to leave that office with something. So in part, it's consumer expectations, and it's the pharmaceutical industry and the physicians all contributing to this scenario. And some of my students are amazed to learn what happens to these pharmaceuticals after we take them. They end up in the sewage treatment system, and they're not filtered out. So they go into Cayuga Lake and into the watersheds, and then the animals eat them. It gets into the bodies of the birds, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's really an environmental health issue that many of us don't realize, because we're such an individually oriented culture, we often don't think of the ramifications beyond our individual bodies.
Yeah, indeed. And also the all the commercials that you see on TV around the dinner hour trying to get people on more and more drugs, it's to me, it's criminal. It just really seems criminal. Now, I want to ask you this. You teach anthropology. What kind of attributes would you want to see in somebody pursuing this career?
Anthropology, in many ways, is a difficult career to pursue, because in the old days, most of us went into academia. Academia has changed significantly to the point that about half of us go into academia. The rest of us have to find jobs in the private sector. And anthropology is something I think is useful from anything from banking and the corporate world to working on sustainability issues or working in national parks. It's a matter of anthropologists trying to sell what we can offer, which is a broad, holistic perspective. We try to see the big picture, which is a really important perspective to bear in our culture that sometimes is so focused we don't see what we're doing it. Obviously, our environmental issues are an example of that. That we practiced too many detrimental things for so long and didn't notice what we're doing until now. We're like, oops, we've made huge mistakes. If we thought holistically and deeply about our choices earlier on, maybe we would not have made them.
Mm-hmm. And are you able to write your own curriculum, and or do you still get pressures from above to be more academic and less activist?
We're pretty free in our department in terms of teaching what we feel needs to be taught and things like that. So we're really quite lucky in being able to offer students what we think they need to have right now.
Mm-hmm. And another one of your interests that I notice in your biography is how food is produced and marketed. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
Local food is obviously better.
Yes, local food is obviously better. And again, I give my students the example of you're going to eat a salad, and you've got a carrot in that salad, and that carrot came from California. Let's trace that back, and let's really calculate all the expenses, both to the environment in terms of emissions and the fuel that took to get that carrot here to Ithaca. And once they start thinking about that, and what else is in my salad? Where did that come from? Oh, Georgia? And we start realizing that our food system is unsustainable, and we really need to focus more on local food. Ithaca College is doing that to some extent in the food service program, so it's really encouraging to see steps being made in that direction. Myself, in my own life, I was really moved to get my own chickens. I had seen the stories on TV about the production of chicken eggs and the treatment of those animals. So I want to really participate in a sustainable way, so I'm going to get chickens. And they eat all the scraps from the kitchen. Every time I go to a restaurant, if there's anything left on the table, we put it all together in one container and take it home and feed it to the chickens.
Mm.
Sometimes the waitress looks at us a little funny. You're going to eat all that stuff later? No, it's going to go for the chickens. So I have this vision of a chicken coop on the quad at Ithaca College, and the chickens will eat all the scraps from the cafeteria, and we will have our own little sustainability loop going, and the students can eat fresh eggs right off the campus.
Yeah. I think there is more of a movement now, people trying to get people to think about where their food is coming from, whereas before they would just, mindlessly just pick stuff up at the supermarket and not even think about where it has come from. Well, what about the marketing of food?
The marketing of food is one where I think consumers are very much unaware of what is going into their food. My colleague Julia Lapp and I are right now working on a high fructose corn syrup project, interviewing consumers. Do you know what high fructose corn syrup is? Do you know when it started showing up in your English muffins, in your tonic water?
In almost everything.
In almost everything. And, of course, we're finding out that consumers didn't really realize that there was this shift between sugar and fructose to corn syrup to high fructose corn syrup, which is genetically modified and seems to have a different metabolic pathway in the body than sugar. And some dietitians and nutritionists are linking it to the epidemic of obesity and diabetes in children because of this different metabolic pathway that it goes through. And so Julie and I were talking to producers like Thomas's English Muffins to find out, why did you start using high fructose corn syrup or Polar or Schweppes or some of the other drink companies? And just recently we noticed that Thomas's is now producing their English muffins with a little thing on the front saying contains no high fructose corn syrup.
I noticed that recently.
Right. So we want to talk to them to find out what prompted you to make that move.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you well in the future. You look like you're doing wonderful things for the community. Tell us one more time about the Homecoming Festival. What's the date of it and where is it?
The Homecoming Festival is at Tutelo Park. This will be the third annual one, September 20th, from 11 in the morning till 6 at night. And what it is we're welcoming home the Tutelo Indians who were adopted by the Cayugas. So we're also welcoming the Cayugas back home because this is their homeland. And so it's a wonderful day of getting to know Native people, eating Native food, participating in Native dance, and just learning about the culture and the history of our region.
Well, Brooke, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you coming by.
Sure, no problem.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.